Whether you're looking for answers to specific life questions or seeking to become the best version of you possible, welcome to the Mental Breakdown and Psych Reg podcast, where we offer insight, information, and strategies based upon research and years of practice as clinical psychologists. So sit back, have a listen, and get connected with our hosts, Dr. Bernie Wilkinson and Dr. Richard Marshall. Welcome back. Richard, we just finished a conversation with a new friend and colleague from Scotland.
I'm glad you referred to him as a friend.
Yeah.
We just met him, but he feels like a friend.
You know, we were just, before we started recording this intro, we were talking about how so many of the interviews that we've had the opportunity to do have just ended up where we have these connections now with people that have just been fantastic. And this is one that where, you know, I'd love to keep in touch with Fraser and follow his work as he's finishing up his doctorate.
I think about it every week. I don't know whether it's that we're all in the same field and we have similar shared interests or what, but you're never sure going into these interviews how it's going to be, but invariably they turn out well. People get excited.
Yeah.
There's enthusiasm. There's energy. And this certainly, there's no exception here.
Yeah.
You know, wouldn't be Dr. Smith yet.
He's not yet.
An emerging Dr. Smith.
That's right.
But no, he was a wonderful, good scholar.
Yeah.
Doing really important work.
Yeah. Well, and as we said, you know, we've done this whole week on men's mental health. And, you know, we kind of got the idea of doing it.
Because of the idea of
interviewing Fraser. So it's Fraser Smith, and he's at the in Glasgow. Scotland. He's studying for his counseling psychology doctorate, and he's been there for a while. He's teaching classes. He's doing different clinical work, doing some research. He's doing all kinds of things, and he found this very strong interest in men's mental health. Early on in his training, and he's really looking into it and has some really interesting thoughts and ideas about this whole idea, about the whole idea of men's mental health.
Right. When I first heard about it, and I have to confess, my first thought was men's mental health. You know, why is this a big, you know, we know that men don't access mental health services as much as they should. And it's sort of a running joke that women go to therapists and men go to bars.
Right.
You know, that stereotype. But it's a very serious issue. And when, in anticipation of this interview, you and I went in and looked at some of the literature and discovered a whole world that we embarrassingly knew very little about.
Right.
And so it led to a 5-day discussion of the issue of men's mental health.
Right.
Opened my eyes up for sure.
Right.
And then this interview today was sort of the capstone experience of this whole thing. And he's doing some great research. And the one that excites me the most is the alarming number of men between 15 and 25 who commit suicide.
Right.
And we know that that exists, but we don't know why.
Right.
And some of his research is to try to understand and learn from. As he says, we have to learn from these, not just chalk up the numbers, but we have to learn why is this occurring and what should we do about it.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that I was happiest to hear was that he feels as though, and talked about it feeling just as sort of uncomfortable talking about some of these things because of societal expectations and everything.
Right.
It is just as challenging for him to talk about some of these things as it is for us, because I was, you know, you try to think about, you know, man, why is it so difficult to talk about some of this? Because you feel like, you know, saying anything about men struggling, whether it's through mental health or professional or relationship-wise, you feel there's almost like a guilt that you feel talking about it because, you know, there is this idea of, or this reality of privilege and everything. And so it feels awkward, but I was relieved to hear that he says that he struggles with some of that as well.
Struggles the same from a social, and he is a social psychologist at the master's level. And so he brings that perspective. But he said, yes, it is. It's the same thing in Scotland as it is here. From a social, political standpoint, it's a ticklish subject to talk about because you feel like you're going to bat for the victors.
Right.
Because we've always we think of white male privilege.
Right, you know? Right. Yeah.
And
absolutely.
He admits, as a white male, he is privileged in Scotland, and we probably are here, or at least we were. privileged here. That may be changing, and that's the conversation.
Well, that's
that
what some of the numbers suggest.
That's right.
That maybe.
That's right.
But so the again, he is very knowledgeable about this, and he is doing a lot as a graduate student who was just married in the last 2 years, and he, you know, he's got a lot of professional and educational and family life stuff going on. You know, he's doing a lot. He has his own YouTube channel called Get Psyched.
Very organized.
And there's a link to that in the show notes. He has his own website, which is Fraser Smith Counseling Psy, PSY.com. And again, links to that in the show notes. But he is putting a lot of information out there. Right. He's doing some, his YouTube channel is similar to what we're doing here, just working to get as much information out and little snippets and little bits of information as much as possible.
A little bit at a time.
Yeah.
What do you call those little things? 2 minute. Minute, 2 minute?
No.
2 minute. Drips?
Something in two. Review in two.
Review in two.
Review in two. I knew it.
Great idea.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we had another topic.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yes. So, check his stuff out. The links are in the show notes. Great conversation. Hope you would enjoy
good
it. And
discussion.
Would love to hear from, hear your thoughts about some of the things we talked about. So,
yeah.
All right.
Enjoy
the podcast. Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm good, Bernie. How are you doing?
Good, good. Glad to get connected. I'm just moving my windows around on this computer screen a little bit. How are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm doing good. I'm doing good. I was up early this morning getting some work done. How's your day been going?
Doing the same. Doing the same. Yeah. Been
good
here
man.
Since pretty early, trying to good get stuff. Some things done to start off the week.
I do. Sounds good.
Great. Great. Well, you know, after getting everything set up to talk with you, we decided that you know, we do little podcasts throughout the week. And so we did a whole bunch of, we did five short little podcasts, recorded them yesterday, all about some men's mental health things, starting with kids. And it makes me feel like there's a whole lot for us to talk about.
Yeah,
it's like a whole thing that we had never even really thought about too much.
No, yeah. I didn't know most of the information. We went and did a bit of a literature search, and discovered all sorts of things that we're embarrassed to say we didn't know about. So we're looking forward to talking to you about this. This is one that simply escaped us.
Yeah, I'm the exact same. I mean, every day when I'm doing some reading or I do some literature searching, it's the same. There's more details that emerge. And I think what strikes me most is that there's still so many gaps in our understanding and in our knowledge. It's enormous. It really is huge.
Yeah, we keep talking about the same issues with boys, about their tendency to be aggressive or to be violent, or but there's all this other information that for some reason remains hidden, at least in our country it does. And I'm sure it's the same in Scotland, right?
Yeah, it really is the same. And it's for me here, it's Europe-wide. I think research is so invested in understanding more about mental health that we sometimes overlook just how subjective mental health can be.
Mm-hmm.
We overlook that for women, mental health is going to mean one thing. For men, it's going to mean something else. For young people, it's going to mean something else as well. And as important as that research is in mental health, it's vital. We need to understand the subjective nature of how mental health affects different people, different groups. That's really the only way that we're gonna tackle and improve it for those groups, you know. But it's so hard to do, and there's such a need for research, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, again, there's so much for us to get into. But you're in Glasgow, right?
Yeah, Glasgow. Yeah.
What university?
It's a Glasgow Caledonian University.
Okay.
So that's there's kind of three. I would say there's three main universities in Glasgow. So mine is a kind of city centre one. I've been there now since 2008. So I've been there for a while. And now I work for the university as well. I'm a researcher, seminar tutor, and I study my doctorate in counselling psychology there too. So
Fantastic. What courses do you teach?
So I teach a lot of social psychology stuff.
Oh,
okay. I teach a lot in social psychology. I teach a lot in statistical analysis, which is that difficulty to teach is a tough one.
Those are fun classes.
Yeah, it's a hard one, and trying to get the students to feel encouraged and enthusiastic about statistics is something else.
So, highly unlikely.
Exactly. Yeah, I teach a research methods class and for a counseling program, and yes, it's very difficult to get some of those students engaged, especially when we get to the chapters on statistics. And I say, you know, we're just going to talk a little bit about it, and yeah. You know, we can get through mean, median, and mode, and then they're ready to stop.
Yeah, that's pretty much how it goes for me. I don't even think I get the mode, to be honest. I don't even get it that far.
Yeah, I tried a couple of times to do standard deviation, and
I'd get to standard deviation, yeah. And then that was it. Then everything was just shut down.
Yeah,
absolutely shut down. Yeah.
So, well, that's great. So, was it in your studies, or maybe even in your work on social psychology? Was it in the time that you were at the university that you started finding an interest in men's mental health?
Yeah, it definitely was. I think it's funny when, as you both will know, I'm no doubt sure, as you continue in deeper education and deeper studies, you realize how much interests have been kind of founded in your history and in your past, and men's mental health was definitely brought to the surface for me when I started my doctorate. It had a lot to do with a mentor as well at the university who, you know, who's been giving me quite a bit of advice on private practice work in the future and employment when I graduate. And he has quite an interest, quite a focus on men's mental health as well. And it's just through reading some of his work and discussions with him that it's, you know, I became so interested in it. And I think as well for over here in psychology and in caring professions, it's a predominantly a female industry, or female-orientated industry, a high percentage of women working in the caring and psychology profession. And so as a man in psychology, in counselling, kind of understanding a little bit more about, you know, how I understand mental health and how men understand mental health, it was, you know, it was really interesting to me, and it just kind of grew from there, really.
Fraser, you said that in Scotland, psychology and the caring professions are mainly the province of women professionals. When did that happen?
How did that happen? Oh, gosh.
No, when? What years?
Oh, when did that happen? Oh, gosh. To be honest, I think when I think back to the establishment of counselling psychology as a recognised psychological field in Scotland, you know, that would probably be in the 90s, 1990s we're looking at. It's really stemmed from there. I remember my first job in counselling was at a relationship counselling organisation, and I was a youth development worker, and we had about 70 employees, and I must have been like 20, 21 at the time, and I was the only male employee. So, you know, I think maybe that experience of being, you know, being a minority in an industry, as a man, really kind of did develop my understanding of how men experience, you know, mental health, how they experience emotions, how they experience feelings, and how they communicate that. With so many things in men's mental health, I think it's so founded in stigma. And being able to receive help and being okay to ask for help. Mm-hmm. And I kind of thought a bit about how that made me feel and how I experienced that. It really did grow from there, I think.
So when you entered the field, it was already dominated by women.
Cool. I would say so.
Right, okay.
I would say so. Yeah.
In our country, I think when I entered the field, it was dominated by men.
Right.
But over the course of my career, it shifted now, and 70% of graduates are women.
Wow.
Of psychology program, of doctoral really? Psychology programs in the United States, 70% are women. So it has shifted to predominantly women.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And maybe it I don't know, because there's plenty of women I know who have an interest in men's mental health as well, largely because of the gaps in literature. But I often find in psychology, which is only natural, and I'm the exact same, you know, people tend to research and specialize in fields that they can relate to and that they're interested in. So perhaps, therefore, we can understand a little bit of the gap in men's mental health. I don't know. It's maybe one of the answers. I find it interesting, though.
That makes sense. And you know, in some of the articles and things that we were reading in doing some of the other podcasts for this week, you know, it seems as though some of that differentiation begins very early. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. We were noticing that, and again, it was surprising to us because we try to keep up on educational research and mental health mm-hmm. research in general, mm-hmm. but it was very surprising to read how this gap is really forming and differentiating males and females, and again, starting even in the elementary school years, and then you have it going into the professional educational careers and stuff. So
yeah, it's massive, and I think only recently we're in our educational system. Anyway, my mother's a high school teacher, and you know, she'd be able to voice this better than me. You know, we've come to have better understanding of allowing boys, even in element, like what you're saying, in elementary school, allowing boys to kind of be okay with their emotions and be okay with how they're feeling. You know, I remember being a young boy and being told that it's not okay to cry, you know, that you've got to suck it up, that there's different rules for you than there are for girls in the sense of emotions and how you're feeling and expressing yourself in those terms. And I think that's something that's only really starting to change more recently. And so no wonder we're experiencing difficulties in understanding how mental health affects men, and fundamentally getting men to access services. You know, it's so hard with the stigma that's attached. I think I really feel passionately about the stigma of men's mental health. And I feel like that is the cornerstone to understanding it better, because the services are there. Professionals are there, experts are there to help with these things, and it's just getting past that barrier of making it okay for men to come and say, I have an issue, I'm having real trouble with my mental health here. I'm still struck by, I'm almost 28 at the moment, and from now until my late 30s, the most likely cause of my death is going to be suicide, statistically. And that's just, it's mind-blowing, absolutely mind-blowing. And to know that, and I hear stories almost every day of people that I've known or celebrities that have died from suicide, and it's just tragic. It's so sad, and we need to get to a point where we understand it better and where we make it okay to access services that are going to help.
Fraser, I have a question, and yeah. I've been thinking about it for 2 days now, and I'm not sure that I'm going to ask it correctly, but I'll try. You're talking about, is it your understanding that we have never, as a profession, we've never been good at providing men with the mental health services that they need, or meant men aren't accessing the services that they need? Are they not accessing them, or are we not making them available to men?
That's a really good question. I don't want to sound like a typical psychologist, but I think it's probably a bit of both. You know, I feel the services that we provide are appropriate, they're there, they're available. Are they completely catered to the needs of men? I don't know. I think that's a question that we need to really ask ourselves, and it comes back to my point about the subjective nature of mental health. You know, are our one-to-one therapy sessions the best fit for men? Perhaps not, maybe they're not. Oh, okay. What I feel though is that we don't publicize mental health as a masculine entity. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think masculinity is what is really the barrier here in a lot of ways. I was talking about stigma. Masculinity and understanding what it means to be a man in today's world and all the pressures and expectations that come with that, if we can understand that better, we're going to be able to advertise those services better to men, directed towards them. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's maybe some issues with how we facilitate those services. Sometimes I question whether one-to-one therapy is the best fit for men. Is that a case where group therapy is better? Maybe not. You know, I think a lot about, there's something in Scotland, we call it a West of Scotland mentality. I'm from the West of Scotland, and the West of Scotland mentality is very much the stiff upper lip kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's very much the just suck it up. It's very much the, you know, the man is the breadwinner, the one that goes out and works, and you come home and you don't complain and everything is fine. And getting over that, which is so embedded in our culture and in so many other cultures, I imagine, it's so hard to do, you know? And like I said, Richard, I think it is a bit of both. I think it is a both how we facilitate the services and how we advertise those services to men.
Well, as a related question, and this is the second part of the same question, in our country today, we're reading, the literature is moving in a very specific direction, and that is that as the status of girl, as the achievements of girls is rising, boys are remaining static or they're falling behind.
Wow.
So there are fewer going to college. Those who go to, there's a higher dropout rate. There's a higher suicide rate, lower education, poor motivation. So the girls have been, in our country, the girls have been boosted and provided with supports to increase their achievement, while boys have been left behind.
Yeah.
And so what the professionals are saying is, now we need to help these boys who are falling behind. But I wonder if we've ever provided the boys with what they needed, or we just expected them to succeed.
Yeah, well, exactly. I think it's an expectation. I think with so many things like that, Richard, we're so reactive. We're very reactive and we're not anticipatory. You know, we see a problem, you know, with like you're saying, in your in America, you know, the diminishing results of boys in school. And we see that and we think, oh my goodness, that's an issue. Let's do something. Let's react, rather than, and it's easy to say in hindsight, but we don't anticipate these things happening.
Right.
You know, we don't anticipate that that's going to happen. And I got to be careful with what I say, but it was only right that the empowerment of girls, and I was raised by women, it's so important that the empowerment of girls and young girls in school is pushed, and the pushing of higher education and in higher professional circles. But at the same time, we then maybe ignore the fact that boys need that as well, or to some extent they need that. And maybe the focus has been on girls, rightly so. Some of the boys might have been left behind a little bit. I think the reactive nature of how we do these things is such a problem. Our government in Britain is the same. If we're going back to men's mental health, the issue of men's mental health, we say, oh my goodness, look at the suicide risks, or the statistics in suicide, and we think, oh my goodness, what are we going to do? We've got to do something now, rather than anticipating these things happening, which is hard to do, but it can be done with work and research.
Absolutely.
And as you say, we're not sure even how to address these issues for men.
Yeah.
We may have to go back a step and say, well, wait a minute, whatever we do, let's make sure we're doing it correctly.
Exactly.
Yeah, rather than just reacting.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That's a good point.
Yeah. And one of the things we found as we were doing, again, some of the podcasts for this week, is we kept getting hung up on with the feeling of, well, it's sort of like an awkward feeling talking about men's mental health and some of these things, because, you know, we tend to think of men as having additional privilege and opportunities because we do live in a more of a patriarchal type of society. Of course, we still haven't had a female president and some of those kinds of things. And so we know that there's still this barrier that women are working to push through and hopefully continue to do so. But, you know, I wonder if part of the, you know, sort of how this cycle works between the stigma of men and receiving mental health treatment and sort of our hesitation or concern or sort of that uncomfortable nature of even talking about men needing help and needing support to get through some of these things.
Yeah, it's a bit misogynistic. Advocating for the victors.
Right. You know, right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And you get
exactly
that uncomfortable feeling like, wait a minute, is this sexism in another package? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I totally agree. And I understand how sensitive a topic that is. You know, it's, you know, the statistics show that for the same job in Britain anyway, men are paid more than women, for example.
Yeah.
You know, so when we bring up issues like, here's an issue for men, I understand how that can sound like, you know, the victor's complaining almost. And it's a shame that it's like that. I understand why it's like that. But at the same time, we can't get past the numbers. We can't get past the fact that men who are, you know, quite privileged men, whoever, I'm just using them as an example when we're talking about victors. I'm in no illusion as a white male. I'm in a position where, you know, I have more privilege than anybody else. There's still statistics are that white men are killing themselves, you know, and men in good positions, men in good jobs, in happy family settings. Why is that happening? It's so hard to, it's so hard to understand it. And again, you guys have brought up a really good point. Something that I've not necessarily thought about is another aspect of stigma, that men are the victors. Yes, you know, men have much more privilege than women, even in today's society, sadly enough, and hopefully that changes. But it results in perhaps there being less research with men, or men being less open about their mental health, maybe out of guilt, maybe out of all sorts of things. I think we need to open the conversation, though. We need to have those difficult conversations, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a generational difference here too. When we talk about income disparity, that's true for the older, for an older generation. I'm not sure that it's true for this younger generation. And the younger generation of men are growing up in a very different world, where what it means to be a man is not as well defined. It's not as clearly defined as it was a generation ago.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
So the victors were victorious a generation ago, not necessarily now.
Mm. Yeah,
one of the things we stated last week is that white males are the least attractive demographic when it comes to college placement, college acceptance. Colleges are after. There was an article this morning that the elite colleges still don't have enough minorities in them, because that's what they're trying to get, are minorities and women. Colleges are trying to attract minorities and women. Companies are trying to attract, university professorships are seeking women and minorities. So the least attractive demographic are white males.
Mm.
I don't think anybody thinks about that.
No, perhaps not.
Because we think of white males as being privileged.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's interesting. I still feel that in today's society, and I only have to go what's going on in America from the news here, but it's the same in our country in a lot of ways. I still feel that as white men, we are the higher privileged demographic,
right?
You know, and I am, you know, as I grew up with a single mother, and I think of, you know, she's a very strong woman, and I think of the things that she stands for and what she fights for and the things that she's done in her past. And as you said, it's a different generational gap. Perhaps that's the case. But it still makes the conversation very sensitive. It still makes the conversation very difficult to have, especially in today's turbulent times. You know, it's a challenging conversation to have.
That's right.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things that sort of, as we were kind of getting into this topic, this area of our field, you know, we certainly were hearing about the issue at Google, right? We talked about, you know, where that, I don't know if you guys got that news, and
I'm not sure I heard this, no.
I still haven't read much about it, but I guess there was a guy from Google who sent out a memo. Now, Fraser, I don't know about where you work, but this is a 10-page memo. I don't know who has the time to write a 10-page memo, but he wrote a 10-page memo.
I think that's why he got fired. It took him 2 days to write the memo.
Yeah,
what are you doing? You're supposed to be programming. Why are you writing a 10-page memo? But he wrote a 10-page memo about how there are, and again, we don't know all the content of it, but the crux of was that there are not many women programmers at Google. And so the statistically, I think it was 70-30 favored towards men as it relates to programming. And then the tech was 80-20 or something like that.
Right. The 30% are women who work at Google.
Right.
And in the tech department, only 20%
were women.
He was making the argument that women just aren't as good at this as men.
Right.
And that's what got him into trouble.
Right.
I see.
And the you know, as we were talking about that and trying to navigate through this, I guess what I'm getting to is, do you think that when it comes to some of these things, some of the, you know, some of the stress that men feel, because I completely agree that that especially white men, you know, there's still a position of privilege, and we are still in a place where we have more opportunities than others.
Yeah.
But I wonder if there's this perspective of a zero-sum game. Like there's only, you know, if people were working from this idea that there's only so much to go around, and when things aren't working out for us quite the way that we expect them to, again, as men, you know, is that what is maybe contributing to some of these mental health issues, because we're distressed, we're depressed, we're anxious and all that, because we were sort of sold this bill of goods that we're privileged and that we should have these opportunities and whatever we want, we're going to be able to accomplish. Mm. And then when we get into the real world, that's not happening.
Yeah.
Because, you know, women and minorities are excelling in some of these areas where they weren't excelling before. Again, which is great, but we've sort of left this other group and this idea of a zero sum.
Right. That there are only so many positions.
Right.
And if women and minorities are taking them, then white males are a discriminated class. Right. They're discriminated against.
Mm. I wonder, but it's such a sensitive issue. I don't think we are in a position to say that the white men are in a minority or discriminated against. Yes, this position, like you said, about the university entrance. Yes, there's requirements. It's the same here with requirements for minorities accessing universities and women accessing universities, rightly so. There's probably statistics and parameters that have to be met, and there's probably not statistics and parameters that have to be met for white middle-class men like me. So the requirements perhaps are lesser. Maybe it's to try and equal the playing field. I think it's right that those requirements are there. I don't think we've got to a point where I can stand here and say I'm hard done by, or I'm in a disadvantaged position. I feel like I live in a society where, as a white middle class man, I'm in more of an advantageous position than any other demographic, which is sad to say, and is really, really sad to say. But it does bring up the issue of, well, what right do I have to complain then? And when we tie it to men's mental health, when we tie it to the statistics of men's mental health, it may be a contributing factor that it's not okay for me to speak up about the issues I've had, because how can I complain? I have all the privilege I could ever want, and that's a fact. I have all the privilege I could need. So how can I say, oh, you know, the full-time job that I've got, you know, the white picket fence house and the beautiful wife, you know, it's not everything I thought it'd be. That sounds ridiculous, but it's communicating those things in the most appropriate way. And I don't want to go into detail, but I have I heard a story recently of somebody that a friend of mine knows, who, quite middle class man, highly successful, wonderful family life, it seemed from the outside, everything that you could wish for, and he committed, he died from suicide, you know, a couple of weeks ago. And you sit back and you think, well, how did that happen? What are we doing to try and curtail this, or trying to understand this at least a little bit better? And what's sad is that I don't think we're learning lessons from these deaths. I think we're closing the door. I think we're scared to talk about it, I think, for numerous reasons. And Richard, you brought up a great point about difficulty in communicating. You know, if I have mental health issues, or I feel like I'm having mental health difficulties, how appropriate, how socially acceptable is it for me to communicate those? You know, how easy is it for me to access services? How applicable are those services to me and my needs? It's such a challenging game with so many different factors, you know?
I agree. Yeah. I think you're right on, because it's, you know, it's difficult to complain when, you know, it has been, you know, our experience that we have more opportunities in those, and you know, whether it's such a difficult thing to talk about and think about.
Really is.
Yeah, my daughter is a recent college graduate. She graduated from college this spring. She is opposed to affirmative action. A woman is opposed to affirmative action. And I tried to explain to her about leveling the playing field and about our past. You know, she's 22 years old and didn't live through the issues that we did. But I think she's touching on this very issue, because I said to her, well, this white male didn't get admitted to the University of Texas Law School. That's the lawsuit that's making its way through our courts. The affirmative action lawsuit is a student who was denied admission to the University of Texas Law School. And I said, but he can go to any number of law schools. If he's qualified to go to that law school, he's qualified to go to many law schools. Mm-hmm. And she just would not agree with us. She said, no, it is still unfair. If he wants to go there and qualify, he should be able to go there. She had nothing to do with race. So she was arguing for the white man in favor of.
Yeah.
But I have another question. You've talked about this and written about this subject, haven't you?
Yeah, to the kind of reasonably early stages, I'm wanting to do a systematic review in about a year's time. So yeah, the literature review, the scoping literature, the starting of writing is beginning now for me.
Now, as you talk about this, have you ever gotten pushback from anybody? Have you ever
pushback
and taken you to task?
Say that again, Richard.
Has anybody taken you to task over this? Has anybody raised the question of why are you even talking about this?
Perhaps not, but perhaps because that's because I've not brought it to the right people. The people, you know what I'm trying to say? Like, the people that I brought it to are academics,
yeah,
and people interested in this field. I think if I was to go out on the street and say what I was looking into, I'd probably get a very different reaction. It would be very interesting to do, and I think it's the kind of thing that the stage we need to get to eventually, where that is a conversation.
Yeah, that's happened here to a couple of college professors, is when they made public statement in a public forum, they're met either with silence or with criticism.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's a very interesting question. I wonder how it would, because it's very easy for me to live in my psychology bubble at university and where I work and study and spend a huge amount of my time and talk to colleagues about men's mental health and they find it interesting and I find it interesting and think, oh, that's great, we can do it. But it's a very different thing if I go and talk to, you know, someone down the street or my neighbor who's a man and you know, struggles to talk about his emotions and feelings. I'm going to get a different reaction altogether. I think eventually I'll get to that point where I feel like I can do that. I talk a lot about men's mental health on my Twitter account and things like that. So I've never had a negative response about it. My Twitter account is full of psychologists, so it's not easy for me to get a real public opinion. You know, I think it's interesting, though. I wonder how that changed.
But if you stay focused on men's mental health, if you take it from a clinical perspective rather than a social perspective, I mean, what we're talking about now is a socio-political perspective. That could get some pushback.
Oh yeah,
talking about it from a social perspective,
right?
You know that men have it, but if you talk about it just from a mental health perspective, and say, and you raise the question, what are we learning from these suicides?
Right,
you know, that's a clinical question.
Yeah,
I don't think anybody could argue with that.
No, that's true. Yeah, and I think when because you can, I've got to be careful using statistics to back my argument, but you can't hide from these percentages and from these, I can't, they shock me every day and I can't hide from it. And I think if we were to relay that information to the general public, we would probably get an empathic understanding and you know, a socially acceptable understanding of why we need to look into men's mental health. You're right, it's different in a clinical setting. But it's a conversation, like I said, you know, I think things that we've talked about today have been very difficult to talk about, but it's a conversation that we need to have. It's a difficult, challenging conversation that we need to relay, that we need to communicate in the most appropriate way. And we need to start doing it, because what would be the most tragic, it's tragic that these men are dying from suicide, but what would be even more tragic is that we just don't learn anything. And we just say, that's really sad, you know, that's awful. Or we think, how can somebody do that? Well, people are doing it and they have reason for doing it. In accordance to them, we need to learn more about it, you know.
Absolutely. You know, I think that one of the things that we talked about, Richard and I, before, is that, you know, we pay a lot of attention to boys' mental health, because we talk about ADHD and oppositional defiant disorder and, you know, problems, but mostly as it relates to problems at school and, you know, what's going on there. But we seem to just kind of forget about this, you know, once they reach adulthood. You know, we don't talk about, you know, the fact that, what, 70%, statistically, 70% of kids with ADHD go on to be adults with ADHD. We don't really talk about, you know, and ADHD is one of those interesting things to me, because, you know, we've always talked about ADHD being primarily being diagnosed in boys.
Yeah.
And then the research started coming out about this ADHD inattentive type, and that there's probably a whole lot of girls that meet criteria for ADHD inattentive type, and they're just going, you know, unnoticed. But we're not doing the same thing with some of the diagnoses that we typically make in girls, like depression and anxiety. We talk yeah. about them still with girls, but we don't say, you know, perhaps there's a bunch of boys who present as angry or, you know, unapproachable or anything like that. And maybe they're struggling, that's sort of their manifestation of depression or anxiety.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Does that seem, I'm not sure if you've gotten into that research or if there is even research in that.
I wouldn't say that I've got into that element of research. I do have my own opinions on the educational system. I can only voice my opinions here. And you know, recently we had in England and in Scotland, we recently had the exam results come out for the young people in high school that are in about kind of fourth year to sixth year, which is towards the end of their schooling life. And with that comes conversations about the pressure that we put young people under in exams, that, you know, this is the kind of end game point, that this is the massive pressure, this is the big, this is a huge deal, you need to do well in your exams. And Bernie, you talked a little bit about elementary school and how we do talk about well-being and perhaps mental health when they're younger children. And when they become older, now is the time for exams, you know, and you've got to really study. And yeah. what's first is that you read and that you write and that you learn and that you practice for your exams. That's what's number one. And as much as perhaps that's the case, you know, maybe the understanding of mental health or well-being in general is put on the back burner. Mm-hmm. I have my own opinions on how, you know, one exam is the be-all and end-all for what you've learned over 2 years. You know, it's not the case. I didn't do very well in my exams in high school, and you know, I'm in a position there where I'm learning to be a doctor. So it's in counseling psychology. So it's never the end, but at that time, you know, you do feel like it is the end. It is the beginning and the end. If you don't do well, then that's it. If you do well, then great, you're onto the heights. But sometimes I think our priorities shift in school, and so things like emotional well-being, mental well-being, can maybe take a back seat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
we have a couple of great, in our state, for example, here in Florida, we have some of those high stakes tests that, you know, in a couple of grade levels, if you don't pass them, you don't go on to the next grade level. So,
right.
And the first one, of course, is third grade. If you don't yeah. pass the third grade reading test, you don't go to fourth grade. No matter what your grades are for the whole school year, if you don't pass that test, you don't go on. In 10th grade, if you don't pass that test, you get a couple of more attempts. But if you get through your 12th grade year, your final year in high school, and you still haven't passed that test, you don't graduate with a standard diploma. And it's amazing because, again, as you put very well, you know, when it comes to tests, we just shift to you need to do well on the test. We don't really take into consideration what effects it's having on the kids or what may be creating some limitations for them.
Yeah. It's actually, interestingly, when I was 17, I came out to America and I went and I stayed in America for a year. I went to high school. In Scotland, I had finished high school, but I went to America to do an extra year of high school so I could play basketball. I used to play basketball a lot. And I went to Indiana for a year. So I've been in an American high school environment for a year, and the pressures, it's so interesting because the pressures that are put on young people in America are very similar to what we put on in Britain and Scotland. You know, it seems just to be a universal thing. Studying was first. Well, for me at the time, basketball was first, but we won't go into that. you know, so it's massive, the amount of pressure that people all over the world, young people all over the world, are put under. You know?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So it sounds like one of the things we're saying is that we need a lot more research in this area, certainly, but we also need to do a better job of reaching out to men and reaching out to males in general, not just men, but even adolescent boys, to decrease the stigma or to deal with the stigma so that they can, you know, be more comfortable coming for support and assistance in therapy. Any ideas or any thoughts that you would suggest as far as how to do anything like that? You know, do we know of a better way to reach out to them or things to say to sort of bridge that gap there?
Yeah, I bridging the gap is a really good way to put it. I wonder the access of anonymous services. So I think of like, I worked as a volunteer telephone counselor for about a number of years ago. And actually we had quite a lot of male callers. Online therapy is becoming much bigger. I've even heard of animated therapy, you know, avatar-based therapy. These kind of therapeutic modalities, if you want to call them, that have more anonymity, perhaps are a way. I feel like that's a bit of a surface thing because I feel like, again, that's a bit reactive. I don't think like we're getting to the crux or the real issue of understanding men's mental health and masculinity if we just kind of hide it by being anonymous or behind a telephone or behind a computer screen. I do think, though, I can't deny that I think those services do help men come to therapy, maybe then later come to, you know, face-to-face therapy or group therapy. I do think what we need to do is we need to have therapy that is maybe catered more towards men and advertised as a masculine entity, as something that men do. I feel a lot of when I look on my Twitter feed or I look on Facebook or even some of the services that I see advertised on TV or in magazines and newspapers, I still feel like it has quite a feminine, theme behind it. I'm not being generalistic. I'm just saying that maybe that's our understanding of masculinity in general. But I do think we need to push these services as being okay for men to access. And we need to do that by reaching out and it being a masculine service. You know, this is something that we do. It's so challenging, though. You know, so hard to do.
Yeah. You know, the idea of, and I'm glad that you used the word, because it's such a word with so many connotations. There's so many different connotations. Is the word of masculinity. Right. What does it mean to be masculine? And we tend to associate it with, you know, assertiveness and aggressiveness and, you know, pushing and all of that. Again, that doesn't sync very well with the idea of let's talk about your feelings and talk about how, you know, how you're reacting to these things happening in your life. And yeah. You're right. Maybe for that reason, it makes the advertising the presentation of therapeutic services as less masculine.
Yeah, totally. So I think understanding masculinity, is the key to this. So I think, you know, it's the stereotypical, you know, the breadwinner, the man who goes out and works, the man who fights at bars, you know, that kind of thing. You know, understanding that kind of stereotypical masculinity. Even not all men do that, obviously, and it's not okay to do that. But like, we need to understand it. We need to understand what it means to be a man.
Right, absolutely. And you know, that in and of itself, you know, tracks back to childhood. We found a statistic this week that I don't remember what the statistic was. I think it was like, you know, 55 or 60% or so of American homes are fatherless. Yeah, you know, so you know, we have very few elementary school teachers who are males. We have very few, you know, so we have a large percentage of homes that are fatherless. And so we don't really have too many positive models for that, you know, masculinity, what it really is, for boys growing up. And so they're left with what we see in media, what we see on TV. And of course, for boys that oftentimes are athletes and, you know,
rap stars,
musicians and actors, things like that, which are not always the best models of masculinity.
Yeah, and what's even more the case, Bernie, is that those replacements for role models are so easily accessible now.
Right.
You know, it's on your phone whenever you want, you know, on social media, on your Twitter feed, on your Facebook feed. You can access those role models. You can access that example wherever, whenever you want. And if you're saying you're talking about fatherless homes, that's where these boys are learning what it means to be a man. That, you know. and all the negative connotations that come with that is, you know, and again, it's another factor that we have to try and tackle and challenge.
Right. Yeah.
I think the whole role model issue is much larger than I had realized. When I was growing up, we had fathers, we had, you know, the role models were athletes, but they were highly moral athletes. But priests and clergymen and fathers and uncles and teachers, those were our role models.
Right.
Today it's very, very different.
Right.
I don't know what it would be like if you're 10 years old and your role models are athletes who are fighting and, you know, beating up women. And
that's a great point. You know, I mentioned this on a previous episode of the podcast some time ago, but it makes me think back to, you know, Fraser, I have a son who's 16. And I remember one day we were talking about something. He and I talk a lot, which is great.
That's great.
But it really adds a very different perspective to my life by talking to him, because we were talking about arguments one day, and we were talking about, you know, somebody had said something somewhere, and, you know, I said, well, why would anybody just get into an argument with that person? You know, clearly that person has no idea what they're talking about, and so, you know, why get into an argument? He goes, well, because you'll be defeated. I said, what do you mean defeated? Mm-hmm. And so the idea that everything is a battle,
right?
And mm-hmm. and it, again, it comes from, even though I feel like I'm pretty involved in his life, he's still influenced by some of these external role models, influences that, you know, everything's a battle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Everything is massively competitive. And that's such a really interesting illustration, you know, of somebody who clearly has a great relationship with their son and is able to communicate. That's what's going to stand the test of time, but it still shows how there's other factors, there's other influences, and you know, we can't hide away from it. They're going to be there. You know, I don't have any children myself, but if and when I have a son or a child, or I need to be aware of the fact that I'm not going to be their only parent in a lot of ways. You know, there's going to be other parental factors. There's going to be other parental influences that I don't necessarily agree with and I don't want my child aligning with. I need to be able to put myself in a position where it's okay for them to come and talk to me about that. And then, again, I've said it so many times, so hard to do, you know, really, really hard to do.
It is. Well, we have kept you for a while this morning already.
We can talk longer, by the way. There's a lot more that we have to talk about.
I know.
There really is. Yeah, I could have been here all day.
But before we wrap up or anything, I just wanted to ask you if there was anything else that, you know, that we haven't anything else that we haven't touched on that we, you know, you'd like to share this morning. You know, of course, probably keeping in mind the idea that we probably need to talk some more,
right?
To kind of get into some of these other areas.
The only thing is just reiterating what you said about it being such a big issue and it being so many. I think we did well to kind of talk on the surface level about many different factors. You know, each of those factors you could spend hours talking on, days on, and there's more as well. And but it's a conversation that we need to open up. We need to have more about, you know.
Yeah, because there's this whole area of, you know, untreated mental health issues in men and how that relates to relationships and parenthood and all of those things. That there's so much, so many other factors that it influences. So a lot more to talk about. But but we really appreciate your time. What is the best way for our listeners to follow you? And you mentioned your Twitter feed earlier, but what's the best way for our listeners to follow you and see what you're doing and what's going on in your life?
Yeah, I mean, Twitter probably is the best way, at F Smith CSI, and that's probably the best way to get in touch with me. I'm doing quite a lot of projects. I've got my website's just launched, FraserSmithCounselingPsy.com. And my YouTube channel gets psyched as well. I'm doing a lot of content on that. I'm putting up weekly uploads. I've got a lot of content out right now, and I'm just trying to develop a little bit more, open up some conversations about psychology for students and graduates and people just interested in the topic. So, I think Twitter probably would be the best shout, best way to get in touch with me for sure.
Well, I'll definitely put a link to that in the show notes and to your YouTube channel, because Get Psyched, it's a great channel. I've watched a lot of your videos, and it's great stuff. You know, I really like what do you call it, the name of it just went out of my head, the is it 2 minute
the review too
The reviewing too. That's right. I knew there was. Like a little thing. But there's that. That's great, and it's what we're doing here with our podcast, you know, really relates well with what you're doing with yours. The idea of just, you know, let's get this information out there for people, as many people as possible, so that they can, you know, be able to take what the research is saying and what everybody sort of what we know professionally, and so they can apply it to their life every day.
Absolutely. And you guys relay that information so well. There's so many different mediums that you guys have looked at and are in, and topics. So, you know, the work that you guys are doing is great as well. So yeah, thank you for that. Thank you for that too. And thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
We enjoyed it.
No problem. It was fantastic.
Let's do it again. Okay.
Yeah, we should definitely do it again. Definitely.
I'd like to talk at length about the suicide issue in particular.
Absolutely.
As you peel that back, stay in touch with us, because we'd like to get that information out.
For sure. I'd love to do that.
Yeah. Good. Awesome. So, so great. Well, we will definitely be in touch, and we'll talk to you again. But for now, have a great day.
You too, Bernie. Thanks so much, Richard. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Catch you guys. See you later.
Bye-bye.